Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Telehealth companies have seen massive growth amidst the coronavirus pandemic. Among these healthcare providers is a large number devoted to mental health diagnosis and treatment. And the shift to online settings has brought about greater accessibility to meet growing demand, but many are concerned about treating mental illness from afar. Case in point is the San Francisco-based Cerebral Inc., which is being investigated for its abbreviated diagnostic practices and the rates at which its clinicians are prescribing medication to clients diagnosed with ADHD. Maggie Sibley is an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of Washington School of Medicine. In a recent article in the New York Times, she was quoted questioning cerebral tactics and outcomes. Dr. Sibley, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What's your assessment in general of the telehealth boom as it relates to mental health issues?
Telehealth as a category is something that can be very positive. At the beginning of the pandemic, your typical in-person providers had to pivot to telehealth in order to be able to see people safely. And there were some benefits that emerged from that. So we can see people who live further away from specialists and now can get care from people who have specific expertise and problems that sometimes they may not have been able to find a provider in their community. And also we're able to engage people at times of day when they might not have been able to drive in for an appointment. So we think there's a lot of benefits to telehealth. Some of the concerns that have been raised recently through investigative journalism are related to new companies using venture capital models that are having a goal of maximizing profits. And then questions are being raised at whether they are minimizing patient contact and not adhering to healthcare standards in order to maximize those profits. So telehealth shepherded in a new opportunity for new models of mental health care, and we have to be careful at making sure that these models are working properly.
I was surprised. I don't know why. I guess I don't look at TikTok, and I think there was another app as well that they were advertising a lot on to attract customers, I guess, patients, whatnot. I've never seen that before. What's the problem with that kind of trolling for clientele?
I'm not sure there's a problem with advertising for mental health services over social media, because one of the benefits of that is people who might not otherwise have identified that they have a mental health disorder could get more treatment. The problem is that mental health care providers who are licensed are supposed to be the gatekeepers of people coming in and questioning whether they might have a diagnosis. And if we as gatekeepers aren't doing a good job sifting through who deserves, which type of care, then we have a bigger problem on our hands.
The ADHD diagnosis is growing in popularity among adults, especially women. That's aside from the issue of Cerebral and its strategies. Can you talk about that and what we know about why that's happening?
So it's only been 20 to 30 years since the entire mental health field recognized that ADHD is a disorder that persists past childhood. And so more recently, there's been a lot more public attention to what ADHD looks like in adults. At the same time, we're also realizing that our classic characterization of ADHD, which was based on observing male children who are typically from white middle-class families, isn't necessarily the face of ADHD in other subpopulations. And so what that means is as the awareness of what ADHD looks like is expanding, people who may not fit into the typical ADHD box are starting to recognize those symptoms in themselves and come forward and get help. And women, for example, are one bigger group of people who that's really applied to.
And I thought it was interesting how you said that in the New York Times article that it's easy for many people to relate to the symptoms associated with ADHD. I guess there's like 18 main symptoms, and if you reach a certain number of those, you kind of qualify, but you can pick and choose. Can you talk about that a little bit, about why it's easy to identify?
Yeah, so ADHD is on a continuum. So it's a disorder that maybe everyone has a few traits here or there, or especially stressful times, they may experience disorganization or poor time management. So we can relate to those experiences, any of us can. The diagnosis of ADHD is given, though, when somebody has a high level of those symptoms and those symptoms impair their daily life functioning in a way that's really causing real problems for the person. And so as healthcare providers, we have to decide where to draw the line between somebody who's just has a little bit of an ADHD-like tendency and somebody who really is clinically impaired and meets criteria for a mental disorder. And so that's where, I think it's great to cast a wide net and have people kind of self-evaluating, am I having trouble because of this? Let me go talk to a healthcare provider. And then, as healthcare providers, it's our job to help sift through who the right people to give the diagnosis to would be.
Right, and that's where cerebral comes in as a problem because tell me what a typical screening would be, how you'd, and maybe let's even say pre-pandemic, what you might have done and how you might what you think is the standard.
So it depends on the age of the person. In children, the diagnoses are a little bit simpler to make simply because there are less possible alternatives that could explain the symptoms. But when you reach adulthood and you're thinking about all of the different reasons a person could be having trouble concentrating or being or have trouble with executive functions or motivation, you can start thinking about a long list of things like sleep problems, depression, health conditions, difficulties with medication side effects, and on and on and on. And so it really becomes a detective work of providers when treating people who are coming to the fold for the first time as an adult saying, I've never been diagnosed with this before. It usually should involve a visit to a physician to do a physical and make sure there aren't health conditions explaining these potentially new symptoms. It involves a comprehensive history taking. Is there a family history of ADHD? What were you like as a child? And then it's also really important to get collateral reports. So other people who know you fill out questionnaires on what you're like in daily life. And we try to understand, is there a pattern that's been going on for a long time? And if you are just coming to the attention of a provider now, can we explain that? Are there factors that explain why you didn't get diagnosed as a child? All in all, we would expect somebody to spend at least 90 minutes with a provider usually in order to go through this comprehensive process. And when it's not clear, coming back for a second visit, follow-up, there's a the process is really customized to how complicated the case is.
So you're filling out all these forms in advance, then the physician takes a look at it, and then the 90 minutes together, and that's typical. And is that the same for adults or children, or is it, did you say it was quicker for children because there aren't
It
as many?
can be quicker for children. Yeah, those are best practices for adults. It
Okay.
doesn't mean that's the standard that everyone's following, but that's what's recommended. In children, sometimes you can have a quicker diagnosis because if the parent fills out questionnaires, if the teacher fills out questionnaires, if they corroborate with each other, and if especially if there's a family history and there's clear behaviors being displayed, when you're younger, there's not too many things that can explain those difficulties because younger children don't have the same kinds of health and other mental health problems as adults can have. So they can often diagnose children with ADHD in a primary care physician's office with a little bit of a simpler process.
At the start of the pandemic, federal regulators relaxed rules around medical prescriptions of controlled substances, which include medications for ADHD. How does that play a role in all of this? It's easier
So
to get it.
the startup companies that were doing online mental health existed before the pandemic for the most part, but there was a new opportunity for them to expand what they were doing into the prescription of ADHD medications when these regulations were relaxed. And so you saw for the first time that there was online offerings specifically targeting ADHD. From what I've seen with the investigative journalism, this is about 30-minute visits. And that might be enough to diagnose anxiety or depression in someone. And maybe that was the model they were following previous to inviting ADHD into their their services, but ADHD is more complicated and takes much more comprehensive assessment for adults, especially than some of the other conditions they might have previously been treating.
And is there any like requirement for follow-up? I was kind of wondering about that too, when they only take a half hour to diagnose, prescribe, is there any mandatory follow-up?
So best practices are once you've prescribed a medication that you closely follow how the person is responding to that medication through visits that might be monthly for a while, or even closer together than that if you have reason to do so. And there are a lot of different types of stimulant medications. There are also non-stimulant medications. Different people respond differently to different medications, different doses of the medications. Side effects can be immediate when you start taking a medication or can creep up over time. So there's a lot of reason that we pay careful attention. It's also the case that medication is not the only effective treatment for ADHD. Cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, is also effective. And comprehensive assessment also understands person-specific factors that might make treatment A versus treatment B versus treatment C more applicable to that particular person. So recommendations should be individualized. And so a standardized process would also potentially cheat patients out of the best care that they could receive.
Some people, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and they said, well, what does it hurt if you just get prescribed? What's the problem? You just try it, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Can you give me some thoughts on that?
The medications tend not to hurt most people. And if people took ADHD medications without ADHD, they would experience cognitive enhancement. So the concern, there are slight concerns with safety with these medications if they're abused. But some of the bigger problems are specific cases that can occur where people are coming online with the intention of obtaining the medications, although they know they don't have ADHD, and not having a careful process to be able to make sure that that doesn't happen. And then also, given that ADHD is a condition that overlaps with a lot of other difficulties, there's an opportunity cost there that if we diagnose ADHD when we should be diagnosing something else that could be helping the person instead, then we're really potentially causing harm there. Because, for example, if you have chronic attentional issues and it's a symptom of an underlying health condition and no one catches that health condition, that could get worse, then we've done some harm there.
Any recommendations for people who want to use telehealth in this way, as far as finding a provider that works properly for them?
Well, I think patients have to be their own advocates and they need to be informed so they can make good decisions. And there may be cases where these telehealth models are a fit for people. I don't think that we're saying that categorically this is bad. If you've had a diagnosis of ADHD for years, if you know what medication you respond to, and if you've been stably on that medication for a long time, conceivably, this could be a more simple way to access care for certain people. And the harms are minimized in those situations. Really, if people think that online healthcare is the best option for them, consider that your local providers also often offer these services and that, that can be a way to get care. And if you're going to try out one of the startups, they're not all the same. Some of them may be offering okay services. Just be aware that you want to be given high quality care. You're looking for someone who's spending time with you. You want to look up the qualifications of the person you're meeting with and make sure they're a licensed professional of the appropriate profession. And if you feel like you're not being, given the care and attention that you feel like would be necessary, trust your gut on that and, consider a second opinion.
Dr. Maggie Sibley, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Maggie Sibley is an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of Washington School of Medicine. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The rate of Alzheimer's and dementia diagnoses is increasing, and experts predict that those numbers will keep climbing as the population ages. So far, there's no cure, but the experts say that brain health is something you can work on. It's rooted in your lifestyle. Consumer Reports editor Diane Umansky worked on the June cover story, Boost Your Brain Power at Any Age. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/all sides. Diane Umansky, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
What's the distinction between brain health and mental health?
Oh, well, I think they are certainly intertwined. One of the things that you want to do to help preserve your brain health is to take care of any mental health issues that you're experiencing. Certainly anxiety and depression have been found to increase the likelihood of cognitive issues, and that's for, you know, sort of a variety of complicated reasons. So if you, like many people these days, are maybe not having the greatest time in terms of mental health, please reach out. It is so important.
How do you know if you're slipping? What are the signs?
Well, I mean, they're, you know, look, as we age, as we, or if we are in extremely stressful situations, we all have slips. And no one in this extremely busy, you know, society we're living in can remember everything and stay on top of everything. There are, however, certain signs that you might want to talk to your doctor. For instance, you know, if you're experiencing mood issues, mood changes for no apparent reason, if you continue asking the same questions over and over again, and particularly if you're also, you know, having some behavioral changes, if you're putting items, look, we all know the, oh my God, where are my keys? Where are my glasses? They're right on my head, you know, trope. But if you are putting things in sort of inappropriate places, like maybe your keys end up in the refrigerator. And again, you know, a one-off of that is no concern, but I'm talking about regular patterns here. If you find that on a regular basis, you're sort of getting lost while driving or otherwise going to places that you're very familiar with, if you are mixing up words like TV and radio, those are all signs that you want to get evaluated by your doctor.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday, and we're talking about brain health today. My guest is Diane Umansky. She edited the June cover story of Consumer Reports. It's titled Boost Your Brain Power at Any Age. You know, a lot of the lifestyle changes that they mention in this piece are things that they just sound like good things to do anyways, right?
Well, they are. I mean, you know, we kind of all know a lot of the basics, you know, get enough sleep, eat right, take care of your health, exercise, reduce stress. You know, doing those things is probably, you know, about the most important bunch of steps you can take. But there are some more sort of specific things that are found to be tied specifically to brain health.
Exercise is a big one.
Exercise is certainly one of the most important things that people can do for their brains and for other reasons as well. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an old saying that what's good for your heart is good for your brain, which holds true. And one of the most important things is getting regular physical activity that helps, you know, keep blood flowing to your brain in the right way and can actually increase that blood flow. It can make your hippocampus, which is involved in memory and learning, actually bigger. Doesn't mean you have to run marathons. You know, the CDC has some specific recommendations, and the experts we spoke to actually say do a little more than the CDC recommends, which is 30 minutes five times a week. You know, if you can do something for 45 to 60 minutes most days, and that can be a brisk walk, not, you know, like I said, running a half marathon, that's where you start to really get the brain benefits. If you can do an exercise program or activity that offers multiple benefits. And that is what we saw with a lot of the research into brain health. If you do things that have a social component, a, let's say, a physical activity component and a learning component, that really sort of gives you a brain benefit. So one of the things could be taking a dance lesson or going dancing. You have to learn the steps, you're getting physical activity, and you're probably doing it with other people. Other things that offer similar multiple benefits are yoga and Tai Chi, which reduce stress, give you some strengthening and flexibility, and at the same time, make you more balanced. And I just want to make a special note that balance is important because one of the big risk factors for dementia is falling down and, you know, having a brain injury.
Yeah, I did a whole segment on just how to fall safely one time. As far as the socialization thing goes, a lot of, particularly as people age, a lot of people isolate, right? That's, is that a sign of decline or is it
a
cause? No, that's good.
I did not mean to interrupt. I mean, it can be a sign of decline if people are uncomfortable in social situations that they were previously comfortable in. But we've all, you know, seen a lot of isolation in the past couple of years, and we've seen how detrimental that can be, partly for our mental health, certainly. But that tendency to isolate can also be a sign that you are experiencing a mental health issue that, you know, needs to be dealt with.
Hearing loss is not a symptom of dementia, but it can play a role in it, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is important to do as we get older is take care of all of our senses, vision, and hearing in particular has been linked to, you know, cognitive issues if you're having hearing trouble. So it's important to make sure that you're getting your hearing checked when it needs to be. And if you need to get hearing aids, get them. You know, they'll improve the quality of your life. I know they're not all perfect, but, you know, they may also reduce your risk of cognitive issues.
They're so much better than they used to be, too.
They are much better.
Food, what you eat, obviously. We talk about brain health foods all the time. It's the same thing with this, right?
It is. It's very similar. And, you know, you will see articles out there on the latest superfoods. You know, look, seafood and especially fatty fish like salmon, great for your brain. But the key is really, you know, a mix of healthy foods. And that means trying to reduce the amount of processed foods in your diet. You know, things that are unprocessed, fresh are best. Sticking with, you know, lots of produce, a decent amount of whole grains, and reasonable amounts of healthy protein, you know, as well as beans and nuts, goes a long way.
And just color is one good way to think about it.
Color is one good way to think about it when you're looking at produce, certainly. You know, there's some evidence that foods that are rich in what are called flavonoids, which are things like berries and pears and apples, have some particular benefits. And berries in particular do seem to, you know, have a little magic to them. But I'm hesitant to say that. Mm-hmm. You know, they have a lot of good nutrients in them. On the other hand, you know, the pale veggies, things like onions, also have their benefits. So, you know, eat the rainbow.
Right. I was surprised that coffee is correlated with lower risks for dementia. I've tried to cut back on coffee, but now I'm thinking maybe I ought to up it.
You know, we're talking about a reasonable amount of coffee, mm-hmm. which you and I are probably both drinking right now. but yeah, that was an interesting study recently, which found that people who drank 2 to 3 cups of coffee and that same amount of tea each day over time had a 30% lower risk of dementia and stroke. I'm not completely clear on why. I mean, there are antioxidants, which are helpful substances in both coffee and tea. It's possible that it's more than that. And it's also possible that coffee and tea drinkers tend to do other things in their lives that are healthy.
It's a correlation.
So it's a little
at
hard
this
to
point.
Tell. Yeah.
Yeah.
Correlations. Always a little hard to tell with food.
What about supplements? You want to rein those in or what?
Supplements are tricky. So I certainly get about a million ads on social media for, I won't say the name, but, you know, the commercials we all see, and they're very touching and they're very well done about these brain boosting supplements. So far, the research has found that they really don't make a difference for most people. There are a couple of instances when people might want to consider supplements. People who have a family history of dementia, may see some benefit from taking omega-3 fatty acid supplements, but that's something you would discuss with your doctor. And also, you know, with aging, the likelihood of deficits in certain vitamins becomes more common. We have a harder time absorbing certain nutrients. So vitamins like B12 and D and folate have a deficiency of those have been linked to cognitive issues. So, you know, if you're of a certain age, you might want to ask your doctor if you should have your levels of these things tested.
It'll be interesting to see what unfolds with the people who are struggling with long COVID and especially the brain fog associated with that. You talked about that in the in one of the segments in this issue, right?
Yes. I mean, brain fog has been around for a long time. It didn't just arise with COVID. There are, you know, a number of other issues, including vitamin deficiencies or thyroid issues that, you know, can cause brain fog, which is basically just, you know, kind of fuzzy thinking and having difficulty focusing. But we have certainly seen a lot more about it with COVID-19 and with what's called long COVID. You know, there's a lot of work going on looking into long COVID right now. We don't have all the answers, but the general advice is, you know, if you had COVID and, you know, weeks later, you're still really feeling brain foggy, please talk to your doctor. Your doc should be able to tell you whether you're a candidate for what is called, cognitive rehab. There are some, there probably will be more of these soon, COVID-19 recovery clinics and centers.
Yeah.
And if you're a candidate, you will get kind of multi-area therapy to help with memory, attention, problem solving, and things like that.
At the close to the start of the article, you have a section on 4 things that are hard on your brain, most of which you can control, one of which you can't. Let's start with air pollution, which you really can't control, particularly poor people.
Yes. You know, as with many things in our healthcare system, you know, poorer people are more subject to the risks. And with air pollution, absolutely, people who are living in, you know, high traffic areas, which tend to be urban areas, or near factories that have lots of, you know, greenhouse gas emissions, are certainly subject to more air pollution. There is not that much you can do. I mean, it does help to be aware of it. If you're living in one of those areas, it's not a bad idea, especially on, you know, sort of very hot, muggy days, days when, you know, that particulate pollution tends to hang around, to, you know, check the air quality index. You might hear it on the news. You can also go to a government site, which is airnow.gov, and that will give you the daily air quality index. Anything over 100 means it's not a great day to go outside and exercise. Mm-hmm. You might want to close your windows. If you have air conditioning, turn it on. And there are some things that all of us can do at home. Don't let people smoke in your house, because indoor air can be quite polluted. A fireplace is a beautiful thing, but that can also, you know, cause a good bit of pollution inside your home. You want to keep your home well ventilated, you know, which of course is difficult if there's a lot of pollution outside your window. But, you know, that part of that means have an exhaust hood in the kitchen or exhaust fans in the kitchen. You know, the smoke from stoves is also a factor in air pollution. So those are some things that we can do.
And speaking of smoking, no surprise, using tobacco, it's not good for your brain.
No. That is definitely not a good thing for your brain. The good news on that is that if you quit, the risks that you've built up can be brought way down. And quitting by middle age seems to be particularly helpful for reducing your risk of dementia, you know, in your later years.
And junk food. Again, I mean, a lot of these things are associated, I mean, junk food, some people live in food deserts. It's a real thing. Sometimes that's all they can get. But junk food, that is that processed food you mentioned earlier, right?
Yeah, processed foods. But that is also, you know, full fat dairy, red meat. You know, these are things that are high in what's called saturated fat. So, you know, if you can swap out low-fat dairy for full-fat dairy, that's not a, you know, so much of a money issue. If you can, you know, swap out some of the red meat for beans,
get your protein that way, right?
Yeah, especially these days with, you know, meat prices, you know, so yeah. High, that makes, you know, a big difference. You know, one of the issues with both highly processed foods and items that are, you know, high in saturated fat is that they increase inflammation, which is, you know, a brain issue, but it's a whole body issue.
Alcohol.
Yeah. You know, here's one of the areas where researchers and research has gone back and forth. What we know is that heavy drinking is absolutely bad for the brain. It kills those nerve cells in our brain that we need. And if you are already having a little memory loss, it will accelerate that. So I think the latest research that I saw on this was that more than 14 drinks a week, which is two a day, actually was linked to brain damage and an increased risk of dementia. The experts that we worked with advise no more than two drinks a day for males, no more than one for women.
Nothing's fair, but so you have it. Diane Umansky, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Anne.
Diane Umansky is an editor at Consumer Report. She edited the June cover story, Boost Your Brain Power at Any Age. And you can check that out. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/All Sides. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up. Stay with us, please. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Women who complain of chest pain wait an average of 11 minutes longer than men to see a doctor or nurse, according to a recent American Heart Association study. What's more, healthcare providers are more likely to dismiss women's complaints about pain and less likely to admit them to a hospital for pain. And the results are worse for women of color. These patterns can make the difference between life and death. Dr. Amrita Carvey is a cardiologist at Mount Carmel Health Systems and the founder and co-director of the Women's Heart Program that's created to increase awareness of heart disease in women and reduce gender disparities in diagnosis and treatment. Dr. Carvey, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I've been talking about this issue on Wellness Wednesday ever since we started Wellness Wednesday. It feels like it never changes. Is the problem with women or is it with the system that you're part of?
Yeah, good question. This is a problem that has been there for a long time, and I think it's definitely multifactorial. It's a problem with general public awareness of knowing and accepting that heart disease is a woman's disease too. And it's also part of our misconceptions, even as healthcare providers, to recognize that as well.
One reason that women with heart disease are misdiagnosed is that they experience different symptoms than men. So partly it's with the patients. We're not as well educated about, we've been kind of indoctrinated with what men face, but we need to know more about what we face.
Yes, absolutely. But one thing that I would definitely like to clarify is that chest pain is still the number one presenting symptom of heart disease in both women and men. So ironically, some of the efforts to increase the awareness of heart disease in women, telling them to, you know, recognize symptoms beyond chest pain may inadvertently have led to a misunderstanding that chest pain is not actually the presenting symptom in women. And so this may lead to the unfortunate event that women may actually dismiss it when it does arise.
Okay, that's a really good point. So what else should women be aware of?
Yeah, some other things that women would look out for that may be more common in women than men are a tremendous amount of fatigue, especially if it comes on just like out of proportion to what they would expect for themselves in the weeks to months leading to a heart attack. Other symptoms to look out for include jaw pain, indigestion, arm pain, vomiting, you know, any of those symptoms, plus chest tightness is also one of them that some people don't consider to be chest pain, and that goes for chest pressure as well. Those are both considered chest pain from a doctor's standpoint, but others may think of them as something separate.
Yeah, the chest tightness thing, I kind of, have a hard time wrapping my brain around that one, what that feels like. I always think of that Jack Nicholson scene in Something's Gotta Give where he says it feels like there's an elephant sitting on his chest. Is
yes,
that what
exactly
we're talking about?
That's pretty much accurate.
It's pressure.
Like a pile of bricks. Exactly. Yeah.
It's hard to breathe.
It's hard to breathe. It feels like something is suffocating you, sitting on your chest, very heavy. That is chest pressure. Chest tightness might be just like the inability to get enough air, feeling like there's some constriction on your chest. That would be chest tightness.
And then as far as arm pain goes, what are we looking for there? What is that?
Yeah,
what do you mean by that?
That is a great question. Arm pain is something that people may experience when they have blockages in the arteries. And that can actually be like with exertion. If they suddenly start feeling shoulder pain or arm pain going down all the way to their fingers associated with some numbness or tingling in the fingers, or sometimes people may even feel like arm pain that goes to the jaw. Like a terrible toothache, huh. Or suddenly their jaw starts hurting while they're running. That would be an example.
Wow. Even women who are experiencing chest pain end up waiting on average 11 minutes longer than men to see a doctor, according to that recent study in the Journal of the American Heart Association. What it makes a difference, right? 11 minutes can make a big difference. Why the stark difference? What do we know about that?
Yeah, and I think that is just part of this misconception, even among us as physicians, to recognize heart disease as being a a woman's disease. For some reason, that stigma is still there, where, you know, you take a woman with certain risk factors and symptoms and a man with certain risk factors and symptoms, then the men will tend to be seen sooner because that's kind of what you hear about classically. But also because, you know, the way that heart disease develops in women can be slightly different. So for example, in men, when there's a heart attack, it can be like a discrete lesion or a blockage. Women are just a little bit more complicated and getting to the bottom of why they may be having the chest pain or getting to, you know, exactly why and how that plaque buildup first started can be a little bit different too. So men will have a single discrete blockage, but women may have like diffuse plaque buildup in the arteries, no single blockage. It can also be not actually any blockage at all, but just differences in the arteries and how they respond to hormones and blood pressure. But those can all still be considered heart disease, and those still very much cause all of the same symptoms of a heart attack. But when you take a patient to the cath lab to look for a single discrete blockage, and you find that more in men and less in women, even though women also have heart disease, I think that is another reason why that stigma still persists, even among healthcare providers.
Women are less likely to participate in clinical trials. When they do clinical trials, should it be one gender per trial?
It should really be both genders, because okay. Women and men have significant overlap in the spectrum of different heart diseases, and it would be wonderful if women were more represented in clinical trials.
Why are women underrepresented?
I think that was dating back to several decades ago, and people did not want to deal with women because they were just too complicated. They had pregnancies, they had menopause. Why deal with this? Why deal with that? And it was just more straightforward to deal with men. But it's really important to still study women, even when they're pregnant, even as they're going through menopause, because without knowing how they respond in these different scenarios, you can never really advance medical knowledge.
Do you think that with more women researchers, we might get somewhere on this score?
I would certainly hope so. And I do believe that. I know for a fact that in the last 3 to 5 years, there actually have been some, significant lobbying efforts as well to include more women in clinical trials.
And then the role of race, what does that play in heart disease? Because it seems like it's a double whammy for women of color.
Absolutely. So, Black women and underrepresented minorities are more likely to suffer from heart disease and are unfortunately more likely to have worse outcomes compared with their male counterparts.
Because if you wait too long, the recovery is going to be different or the treatments maybe not going to work as well.
Absolutely. The delay in diagnosis, treatment, management, all of that can certainly lead to worse outcomes.
If you think you're having a heart attack, should you walk into the emergency room and say, I think I'm having a heart attack?
I would definitely encourage anyone who thinks that they're having a heart attack to call 911. And then if they are seeing a medical professional, to let them know that.
And just like tell them, not tell just the symptoms, but just say what in your gut you think might be happening.
Absolutely. The patient always knows what's best and what's going on with their body. We trust more about what people think more than anything else, because they ultimately really do know when something is actually wrong.
What's the it's not a stigma, but the presumption that some women can have a higher threshold for pain?
That should absolutely not exist. I mean, and they do, they may have a higher threshold for pain, but even if they do have a higher threshold, or some women state they may because they have a history of dealing with difficult things, it should not be something that they should be forced to deal with. They should definitely report pain when it does arise.
And why is heart disease rising among younger women? What do we know about that?
So all of the risk factors for heart disease are starting to occur in younger women. And the reason for this is because obesity rates are also going up in younger women. So all of the other downstream effects, including hypertension, diabetes, high cholesterol, all of those cause heart disease at a younger age.
Is it because of the age, is it harder to get through to them? I mean, and to make sure they understand what those risks are?
Absolutely. And I think people may misunderstand that, oh, you know, I'm a 30-year-old woman or I'm a 35-year-old woman, and so this shouldn't be happening to me. I shouldn't be having a heart attack. But the reality is, if any of these other risk factors are there from a younger age, that can certainly happen. And, you know, actually, it even starts much earlier than young adulthood. Even if you go into adolescence, with the rate of all of these issues happening at younger ages, including into adolescence, this can actually start at very young ages. Sadly, I would say that I have had many women in their early 30s who've had heart attacks, sometimes even in their late 20s, which is definitely more unusual, but it can happen.
Does it present differently at that age?
Well, that's in terms of like a heart attack, it would probably be similar, but the manifestations of heart disease are very, very large. So even if it's not, you know, a specifically a heart attack that occurs at a younger age, some of the other things that women go through will be complicated by heart disease. So for example, pregnancies can be higher risk if they develop coronary disease when they're pregnant, or if they develop problems with their arteries when they're pregnant, that are, you know, go beyond coronary disease, that can complicate their pregnancies as well. So I think that the presentation in younger women should not be limited to only heart attacks, but really a spectrum of everything that can happen with their heart at a younger age.
You know, I'm thinking about it. The question before me is, what role do depictions of heart attacks in popular culture play in contributing to the misunderstanding of heart disease? And I'm trying to think if I've ever seen a woman in film or television ever have a heart attack.
Yeah, I don't think so. Actually, I can think of one. It's okay. in Two and a Half Men. Do you watch Two and a Half Men?
No, but I will if there's a...
Okay. Well, the mom, Evelyn Harper.
Okay.
She actually pretends to have a heart attack, so I guess that doesn't do it. Do the stigma any better, but yeah. So no real heart attack, no real fake heart attacks on TV.
Do you think that would help, or do you think depicting them on film and TV is bad anyways?
Oh, I really think we need to increase awareness of heart disease in women. So, you know, on TV, you always see a guy clutching his chest, but it really should be, you know, if ideally, if there's some way to make it clear that it can happen to both sexes, then that would only help increase public awareness.
Well, Dr. Amrita Carvey, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
That's Dr. Amrita Carvey. She is a cardiologist at Mount Carmel Health System and the founder and co-director of the Women's Heart Program, which was created to increase awareness of heart disease in women and reduce gender disparities in diagnosis and treatment. Thank you so much for listening today. This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.